Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
We want to thank the sponsors for this session, the Journal of Alta California, and new magazine. And I'll say it now, and we'll also say it at the end, but at the end of the event, the authors will be signing books in the lobby. I would ask you now, and I'll ask you then, to let us get back there. So we'll exit, and then you all are welcome to join us and get in line. It's a very unusual book event for me because it's really two events in one. We're celebrating two books, naming Mount Thoreau and Dubie Lane, two books of eccentric adventure. And what holds them in common is the voice and work of Gary Snyder. He has contributed to each of them. He might argue a minor contribution, but I can assure you it was a major matter for the co-authors of these two books. Gary has lived himself a life, a collection of eccentric adventures, from a boyhood of mountaineering and work in isolation in the woods to an academic career that centered on his devotion to anthropology and Native American studies, then followed a spell as a professional seaman and long years of study in Japan in the cold rigor of Zen practice. He's now spent nearly 50 years living the adventure of being a homesteader in the Sierra foothills. He spent years living off the grid before people understood what that meant. And there is another shadow figure over our afternoon, Henry David Thoreau. Lori Glover and Kim Stanley Robinson have shared a devotion to Thoreau, and they had a dream. After discovering there was not one already in the West, they thought, let's name a peak after Thoreau. Little did they know that this was not as simple as might have been done by Chief Joseph or Lewis and Clark. They have to deal with a crisscross network of federal agencies, and they also have to find the perfect peak. Gary Snyder was their perfect partner. Lori was the prime mover of what became naming Mount Thoreau, and I will have her introduce her cohorts in the first half of our afternoon with a story of how this book came apart, I did proofread this. I did.
It's actually very well
bound. What
they've
discovered about naming and memory. Lori?
That was a great segue, actually, because I was going to start by saying this was not a book that we set out to make. We actually just set out to get together and do some things together. Stan and I had been together at a gathering 5 years earlier that was set up for us by David Robertson, who's one of the contributors to this book. Gathering together as wide a range as there was a judge, there were photographers, there were poets, there were science fiction writers, there were scientists, and we drove around the Eastern Sierra and looked at stuff, but mainly we talked to each other and exchanged ideas. So we wanted to do that again, and our friendship is actually based on meeting at that gathering. We talked back and forth about, we got to get David to do it again. And then we realized David was not interested in doing it again. We were going to have to do it ourselves. And our desire to do that then intersected with conversations that Stan was having over a series of backpacking trips. So I'll let you tell that story.
Okay. Well, thank you. Pleasure to be here. And after a lifetime of backpacking in the Sierra, I had also been reading John Muir's journals and Henry David Thoreau's journals, and talk a little bit about that connection later, but the names in the Sierras range from really stupid and obvious or even inappropriate, like Twin Lakes or Matterhorn Peak, which doesn't look like the Matterhorn, and it's a silly name, to really great names like Scylla and Charybdis, or the peaks around the Evolution Basin are named after the famous evolutionary theorists. And it occurred to me after a while looking around that although Muir's name is all over the Sierras, which is appropriate, there's nothing named after Henry David Thoreau. And then one day we were hiking down Paiute Canyon on a snowshoe trip, and to our left was Mount Emerson. And there is a peak up there named by Muir, Mount Emerson. It isn't clear that it was that one. It might have been Mount Huxley. But anyway, we were going down canyon, Mount Emerson on the left, unnamed peak on the right. Slightly shorter, a lot more gnarly and interesting than Emerson, which is a very simple pyramid. And I thought, that's Mount Thoreau. And then when you go into the Sierras by way of Paiute Pass, which is an old Indian pass and very commonly used, you'd be going between Emerson and Thoreau to get into America's backcountry. So this was just an idea, and it would have stayed an idea if it weren't for Laurie and David Robertson and Gary and everybody in what we call the Mount Thoreau Collective. And names cannot be bestowed on wilderness areas. The Wilderness Act of 1964 says no more new names in wilderness areas, which is interesting, maybe even appropriate. But the formal process is formidable, and you can't really get it done. There's a Mount Andrea Lawrence that got named in a wilderness area, but she lived there, and she was. It took a big effort. And the effort to get North Palisade named after David Brower failed in Congress when a congressman from the area said radical environmentalists had done enough damage in this country. And so there isn't, it's not Brower Palisade, it's still North Palisade. However, the guidebooks and the entire Sierra community have a habit of naming peaks up there anyway and putting quote marks around them in the guidebooks and in the internet listings. So that Mount Darwin, the next peak down the range is Mount Mendel, and the third peak down is Mount Stephen Jay Gould, in quotation marks. So it's kind of beautiful. And so I talked to a guy at U.S. Geological Survey's Bureau of Names, really friendly and informative person. He said, don't even try. You'd just be wasting your time. So we went with the quote marks and did this naming ceremony informally.
And doing that, it was... I'll just say right now, I had to come out before we came up onto the stage because I didn't know who among who I call the Thoreauvians were actually here. We also didn't know that day that we decided to do this summiting, to do this naming, who was going to be there. We sent out a message to a whole group of people and said, we're doing this thing. Come and join us. Here's where the peak is. Here's where the campground is. We'll see you up there. And miraculously, 11 people actually got there. Three people got lost. They're part of our group, but they are famous now for having actually not made it to the peak. We went up on a Thursday. We spent the night in the just next to some lakes. And then the next day went up to the peak and then back down and then all the way down to our cars. And then from there went on to, one, we had a few fixed points. One was the Valentine Camp of the Sierra Nevada Aquatic, I'm forgetting the research lab, or SNARL, yeah. We call it. We had made a reservation at these incredible old cabins for 20 people, unfortunately, 20 people. So there were 11 that went up, and then some other, the lost ones appeared, and some other families appeared. So the chaos of today is quite similar. I think there's only one of the other authors in the audience. So Daryl, will you stand up? This is one of our authors. Stan also has an essay in the book. I wrote the introduction and then an essay at the end. Is there anybody else among our collective that I did not see when I walked out? This is the way things go for us. So Daryl, thank you for being here. We got there then on that Friday night. We spent the next day actually going in various directions. And then on Saturday night, and this is how the book started to happen. On Saturday night, we had asked people to bring something to say about Thoreau. But that turned into people had things to say about Gary, or people had things to say about Muir, or people had things to say about what Stan had said about Muir. So we started to get this amazing layering. And the next day after that, people started saying, you know, we should make a book out of this. And then they said, and Laurie, you should do it.
We knew that was the only way we'd get done.
And I am an organizer. So, but we were also, it was not the summiting that was important to us to do. It was the being together. And then somehow putting the book together is a way of bringing that to every reader who picks up the book. So you'll be joining us when you pick it up and look at it. We also had a couple of photographers with us. One I really need to call out, Christopher Woodcock, a young man who did not go up with us. He actually summited, it wasn't Emerson, it was the peak on the other side. You know the name of that one?
He was up on the Lamarck Coal Ridge.
So he went up a different peak and spent the night while we were in the high country campsite, and then basically ran down and ran up and joined us so that he could take photographs at dawn and then at the summoning. What he does that's amazing, he does long exposure photographs that capture, what did you say the other night? Capture every crystal of the granite. So those are also in the book. Mm-hmm. Some of the talks that we did are not what ended up in the essay. So I asked Stan to say a little bit about what his talk was to give a sense of the kind of thing that happened.
I think the night got sparked by our friend Paul Park, who lives in Williamstown, Massachusetts, who had come out for this thing. And he read Thoreau's passage on being on Mount Katahdin, which is one of the most famous passages in American literature, but especially nature writing and wilderness writing. Thoreau climbed Katahdin and had an overwhelming ecstatic experience, which he, being one of the finest writers in American history, tried to get down how it really felt. And so Paul read that with a tremendous skill and power, and it went on from there. And I ended up talking about Thoreau's impact on John Muir, because naming the peak in the Sierra after a guy from Massachusetts, one of the reasons to do it was that John Muir was someone gave him a copy of Walden when he was still at University of Wisconsin, and at that point he was in his mid-20s. And he had the habit of every book he read, he went to the back fly leaf and he made an index of his own, page numbers and things he found of interest that he could get back to. So when you have Muir's copies of a book, which are all done at University of Pacific in Stockton, they even have his library set up as a room of its own, you can see what he read and what he thought about. And he actually read Thoreau's journal beginning to end. Now, that Thoreau's journal in its complete text was published in 1906, and Muir died in 1914. And in those last 8 years of his life, he was away from home in Martinez about half the time. So Thoreau's journal in its full text had first been published in 1906. It was 14 volumes of the 20 volumes of the complete Thoreau. It's 7,000 pages long. It's 3.5 million words long. And University of Pacific has the proof that Muir read every volume right to the end with notes at the end. Thoreau had a dream about climbing a mountain in east of Concord that wasn't really there. It's one of the most unusual and you might even say bizarre passages in all of Thoreau. And Muir has a note for that page, and he says, "Strange dream." And this is the kind of thing that he did. It was not extensive notes, but it was proof of reading. And what I want to end with is this thought that except for the editor of the complete journal of Henry David Thoreau, in terms of ordinary readers getting the book, getting the 20 volumes in the mail from Houghton Mifflin or whoever it was, maybe it was Harcourt Brace, and then reading it, that John Muir may have been one of the first humans to have ever read the entire journal of Henry David Thoreau. It just statistically has to be true that there aren't that many people that read 7,000 pages and keep notes. So I think this is a great lineage, that Muir wrote 10 or 20 books of his own. A lot of them are magazine articles. They had been put through the sausage machinery of magazine articles, and I know what that's like. That's very bad for you as a writer. And Muir's best writing is not in the bulk of his writing, because those were magazine articles. But when he was good, he was doing what Thoreau taught him to do. So I think it's really a nice addition to the Sierra Nevada to have Thoreau remembered in that way.
Yeah. So then I'm going to say one more thing before I hand off to Gary. Going into the wilderness has kind of become the property of the young, and conquest and energy and going to the top of something and sort of going to the extent of your powers is the story that we often hear about going into the wilderness. But for us, it was as much that going out to the extent of our powers, experiencing our friendship with one another, but it was also going out with a sense of loss. Many of us were suffering something. One of our Thoreauvians, or one of the collective, had lost his wife. Another had had a partner leave. Two of the greatest mentors of the group didn't, in fact, do the summiting. But yet, they were with us and anchoring us. So as Thoreau was anchor for Muir, and we are anchors for each other, that anchor is as much about the wilderness as about the friendship and the lineages between us.
That's very nice, yeah. So then, because they didn't know what else to do, they asked me to write a preface, since I hadn't gone. But I'd slept the night down below, just below North Pass. I guess that was about 45 or 5,000 feet elevation there.
9,000.
Nine. No, North Pass.
Yeah, North Lake, 9,000 feet.
North Pass? Is that high? Oh, well, then I was a lot higher than I thought I was. Okay, well, I'm going to read a little. I didn't write a whole lot about this, but it's worth saying. It's a little piece called Working My Way Toward Henry David Thoreau. In my early teen years, I scraped hides and tried to sew plains-style moccasins. I did my own beadwork. My interest in Native American cultures was practical and physical. I wanted to learn how to use the things from our local forest up in Puget Sound in daily life. And for a while, I even wore my own moccasins to my eighth grade class. Somebody gave me a copy of John Muir's life, and I was immediately taken with the possibilities of dry bread and tea and sleeping out in an old army blanket, an old army overcoat. And I already had a pretty good idea of going out on long rambles over the rocks and through the woods. But in northern Washington, it was not easy for a kid to get up on a true cascade-type peak. Joining in on Mazama climbs, starting with Mount St. Helens, and then on to Mount Hood, Mount Adams, and the others, put me into mountaineering mode for many years. The need to make my own way connected me to Forest Service fire lookout and trail crew labors in impossibly beautiful wild locations, and the combinations of these skills led me into logging and fire camps, which meant higher pay between graduate school winters. So college drew me to Ovid, Edward Sapir, Franz Boas, John Wesley Powell, and the eminent European thinkers. And I stumbled onto Thoreau, whom I had avoided because I thought his part of the world, New England, was just too tame. But one lookout summer on Crater Peak, I read Walden and realized that he had influenced Muir, and not the reverse, and that the reach of his mind was enormous. So, though I had walked many of the High Sierra backcountry trails, I didn't fret in those days about the absence of Thoreau's name. But when friends, especially Kim Stanley Robinson, pointed out that if Mount Emerson had a place out in the West, then there should always also be a place for HDT. And I joined in just when they had found a great place in the right spot, and the solid name was Peak 12,691. That's what all of the other mountains in the high country are named after, is numbers. So are you going to read some?
No, you go on to...
You may read the...
Otzi.
Onward.
You may read Otzi now.
Oh, we're almost done here.
Yeah, with this half.
This is just the first half, Gary.
Yeah. It's not even a half. It's the first third. The thing is that we have all kept on thinking and imagining and working with what the possibilities of our wild landscape of North America has been and what it will be. And of course, it will always be. And I have to find this.
Yeah.
Can you find it?
Yeah.
The editor always knows.
I know where it is. I know where everything is in this book.
Yeah.
Okay. There.
Okay. And I had just been in a year or two earlier than that. I'd been in the Alps with a friend of from northern Italy, Giuseppe Moretti, who is the leader of the French bioregional movement and the editor of a journal called Lato Selvatica, which means on the wild side. And he said we should go visit Atzi, the Iceman, the 5,500-year-ago man who crossed over the Alps and didn't quite make it and whose body was just found a few years ago under the snow. You remember reading about that, I'm sure. So we went to the little town of Bolzano on one of the main Alps crossing highways. It's not such a little town. It's got 100,000 people. And that's where the Otzi Museum is now. Otzi is the German word that means Iceman. I concluded, having looked at him a lot, that he had been crossing the range to get to a settlement on the other side where his daughter lived. That was my idea. He had unfinished arrows in his quiver, and that's true, that he could finish over the winter. And he'd return then to the south side of the range next spring. Moretti and I had spent the day in Bolzano studying his tools, his clothes, his herbs, his flints, everything about him. And then when we were up on the Dolomite Ridge near Sella Pass, I realized that we were looking far out there at the range that he had indeed crossed over. And it all fell in place. So I thought, on his way, he walks steady up the slope, bedrock and plant clumps, wind in his ear, beard waving a bit in the breeze, low clouds from the west in puffs, passing over and through the high peak points, blue gaps seen, farther on a set of white and gray cloud puffs hides a ridge. View through a notch to farther blue cloud shadow patches and sunshine. Breeze softens, getting into snow now. Sun behind clouds, still lots of light. Sore knee, painful shoulder, but about to step out on this ice field, cross it, and go down the other side. More snow and rock and alpine fir below. This moment, sun and wind. My little knife, my fire kit, my settled daughter. This lonely route. 5,500 years ago, I thought, ah, Thoreau got started.
Hey, Jack, before we shift over, because we're going to shift over to the other book, I just want to add a super important member of the Mount Thoreau Collective was Tom Killian, you probably recognize. And this is his version of Mount Thoreau as seen from Paiute Pass, and is a beautiful, it sort of puts the mark of authenticity on that peak. I mean, it can't be anything but because Tom did this. And what I noticed, though, just to pass it along, is in the counterpoint book of Tom Killian and Gary Snyder called California High Sierra, one of Tom Killian's earliest prints is of the Sierra Crest with Mount Humphreys, Mount Emerson, Paiute Pass, and therefore Mount Thoreau, a little nubbin, but Tom's always so accurate, you can even recognize it. And this is from like 1975, that woodblock print. So we have that too. We have another secondary Tom Killian print of Mount Thoreau. It's kind of a nice coincidence.
Very.
And
is
I would
Tom
like
here?
To end just by saying thank you to Lori and thank you to Gary.
Is Tom here this afternoon?
No, he's not here.
I can't see a thing out there.
No, no Tom. But he's always here, right?
Always here.
California's great artist.
So next up we have Doobie Lane. Now I think we're going to have time, by the way, for questions from the audience. So we'll try to allow for that at the end of these two presentations from all of the panelists. But next up we have Doobie Lane. This wonderful book was a true collaboration.
Yeah.
For several years, Gary spoke to me about the idea for this book. Excuse me. He introduced me to this wonderful photographer, Peter Goen, and together we made our way to the great book designer, David Bullen. Peter would be here himself, but this particular day is the day of his daughter's wedding, long in the planning, as those things often are, and he could not miss it. Really?
Good idea.
We could spend a whole afternoon talking about David Bullen's work in the book arts, but that will have to be another day. But because of Gary, the four of us, designer, writer, photographer, and publisher, met here in Berkeley to discover what we might do together. So we will have Gary by himself this afternoon, and I'll begin by asking him to explain his own introduction to Doobie Lane, the place, and the proprietor of Guru Road, Dwayne Williams. Gary once said that if the 60s had produced nothing else, it would have been worth a decade to have produced Dwayne Williams. Gary took it upon himself to transcribe many of the plaques of this great outsider artist and that he produced, and he will read some of them for us this afternoon. But as our afternoon concludes, let me stand aside and let Gary describe how he first came to see this place, Doobie Lane, and what happened thereafter.
You've all heard of the Black Man. I'm sorry, the Burning Man.
Yes.
Thinking the Black Rock Desert.
That's even worse than me.
Yeah, really. The Black Rock Desert, the main part of it that is actually honored and considered is a playa. That is to say, it's a late ice age lake bed that has now totally dried out and is almost absolutely flat for miles and miles and miles. I started going out to the Black Rock Playa 40 years ago, a place to explore, a place to go look at the stars from. And you can drive your old truck or car around on it anywhere you like with your eyes closed. That's where I taught my younger daughter to drive. And told her, you don't have to worry about steering at all.
Is she still driving?
Oh, she's a good driver now. You bet she's driving. In the course of exploring, and I've done a lot of explorations like that, over in Nevada and into the Great Basin of the desert country, and it's truly dry, I stumbled onto this little road that had a tiny wooden sign in a very low, foot-high stake in the ground that said Doobie Lane. And then it was coming off of that little narrow paved road, which went all the way to the Oregon border, and just rambled around through the rocks and dirt and miscellaneous wilderness desert landscape for a couple of miles, rejoined the paved road. But this funny little sign that said Doobie Lane was charming, so I took my truck and went up on that. I was out with my wife of that time, Carol Coda, who is now gone. And we discovered, driving slowly down it, that place by place there were inscriptions on the rocks, writing, little slogans, little bits of language on the rocks for a couple of miles, irregularly spread out in convenient places, dipping down a little, climbing a little bit again, and then finally rejoining the paved road. And the paved road, which never has any traffic anyway, went on for a few more miles, and then the little dirt track side road that goes out onto the playa and goes to the Burning Man nowadays, whenever the party is being held, was right there. I was so taken with it that I went back again, and with Carol helping me, spent a whole afternoon writing down what the rocks said on them. And gradually learned about the man who had done it. And I'll read a little of what that is. And then we'll get more of the story, too. Duby Lane, just north of the tiny town of Gerlach, Nevada. A testament inscribed in stone tablets. 150 miles, a town of 150 people, 100 miles from Reno, a sign in the bar that says, "Where the pavement ends and the west begins." At the edge of the Black Rock Desert to the east and the High Rock Canyon country to the north. Continuing out of Gerlach past Bruno's Gas, Bruno's Motel, Bruno's Bar, and Bruno's Cafe. Taking the fork toward Via on the Oregon border, a mile or so on. A bulldozed out leveled area on the left where several cars could park. A rock standing vertical on the top of the bank, 18-inch high sign, same stone, clean letter engraved into it saying, "A good place to make love." Just a bit down the road, a series of inscribed rocks standing with their flat faces toward the dirt road. Clear, sans serif, Roman alphabet scratched through desert varnish. A light gray rock, special people. Next rock, brown. Very important person, Bob Gooch. Four smaller rocks in a row. Maybe we all should look so good, with an arrow pointing at the name Marion Gooch. Carol Minto, Gary and Trudy Minto. And it continues with Doug and Robin, Doug and Robin Watt on a rock, Tom Cat and Diana Rios, Dale Doodle, Pot of Gold, Artie Johns, Tim and Vicky Williams, Mitch and Connie Ugalde, people who are famous, Amy Lou Weldon, Miss Personality, Tori Conley, Stars on the Horizon, Becky Green, Vanessa Denokin, We Are the Future, Susan Rios, Cecil Courtney, Ashley Moss, People Who Care, Mary Mum, Dan Devaney, Patsy Sumac. People Who Live and Let Live, Al Linda and Jim Bogle. Keeping the West Alive, Jackie Sid and Kelly Lyle. 8 more feet, open ground, and then Fred Chez has the beef. And I have Fred, says Joe Chez. A rock standing by itself, a nice tall rock, saying, "Nothing so small that you can't cut it in half. Nothing so large that you can't double it." Standing by itself, a sign, "Gourmet Cook, Leonard Williams." Desert Diamonds, Joanne and Vanessa Danigan. "Kipping Vezi is my name and poetry is my game." Back away from the road stands a twisty juniper trunk with a rock hanging from a string, from a limb, with a stone inscription below, "If rock is moving, it is windy." wet while it's raining or snowing. Gerlach, weather station. And a big natural rock just says Dwayne, D-E space W-A-Y-N-E. I'm just selecting as I go through here. I'm not reading every one at all. The best things in life are not things. A loss is a win. Just knowing you have 100 friends. Thanks for your support. I love ya, Doobie. And another group, waste not, want not. Birds, please, shit on the rock. A sign says, what goes around comes around. China will rise again.
Good call.
Yeah, really, 30 years ago. This is 30 years ago, actually, that I copied this down and make these selections now. And all of these, or a lot of them, have gone through transformations and changes over the years, which I haven't really tried to keep up with, but Peter Goin, the photographer, has done it, and some of the people in Gerlach finally became aware that this was going on only 5 miles outside of town. As I understand, these are also inscriptions in the rocks. God loves us all, not because of what we are. Do you believe that the blind are leading the blind? Another sign, no tools, no discrimination, no sex.
All this before dope was legal.
Well, so I have to tell you that eventually, on one of my trips up here, when I checked out Doobie Lane over the years, I ran onto Dwayne Williams. I was walking through the unfolding tale of his community and the wise and funny tablets of philosophy and advice with amazement and delight. I was moved to record it on the spot and later met Dwayne, the maker, on that very road doing another installation. I asked him, why was he doing it? He said, well, he had grown up there at one time and then had had other jobs in other parts of the West. He said, well, I've got cancer and I'm going to die. And I'm getting these mushrooms from China that maybe will save my life. And he said, and if I feel a little weird or not so good, I smoke a doobie. He said, want one? This is before anybody ever talked about legalization or medicine. So Peter Goin has taken a whole series of really wonderful photographs of these different rocks with their inscriptions, with the mountains behind and rings of stone around little clear patches of ground, and then a big boulder with inscriptions on it. The guru says, rejoice in the success of others. That's one inscription here. Tell people, smile in the same language. Fame will take a piece of the heart. Tell them that I am dead. and another little sign on a big boulder here. Only the truth will set you free. Breathe the power. Everybody is somebody. Everybody has to be somewhere. A word from space. Never say die. Don't panic. Insanity is the only true adventure. The truth has no author. Anonymous. And then a series of them. One life to live. You must have something to do, someone to love, something to believe in. That's four rocks. And then a dead, twisted juniper, probably, with no green on it and no limbs, and a sign at the base of it. Tree planted by Doobie. Please don't pick the fruit. And this road also had another name on this, another sign. It had a second sign that said Guru Lane. And here's a sign, a rock that he inscribed, "Listen to the Guru." And another one, "Respect your elders. When they die, they will have seniority." It's very difficult to appreciate this book without the photographs as well as the inscriptions. An eye for an eye makes the world blind. There are some descriptions in this book of how some of the citizens of Gerlach, who are mostly old ex-miners and truck drivers, ended up finally forming a little organization to take care of Guru Lane, to clean it up, and some irresponsible outsiders came and put their own inscriptions up, and so they took those down. You know, local conscience. And that's, what can I say at the end of this, anyway? What I would like to be able to do really is just, you know, respect your curiosity and answer your questions. I'm going to read my little afterword to it all, though. Carol and many neighbors and friends and I made trips to the Black Rock Playa over subsequent years, and I always stopped and re-walked Guru Lane. I met Wayne DeWayne Williams right when he was working on a new installation. There were many. He knew that I was a poet and a desert rat, and the two of us related as artists with a certain distance and reserve in our frayed and dusty jeans, squinting in the sun. He told me of his cancer and the mysterious fungus coming from China to help him. Yet later, a few independent and sometimes clumsy installations that didn't last long were inserted by outsiders. A group of locals put themselves to looking after Guru Road, keeping it trash-free and remaining DeWayne's own project. Then the remarkable unfolding of the annual Burning Man gathering began. Guru Road, as close as it was to the entrance for Burning Man, seemed almost invisible and was usually overlooked by the streams of cars that turned off the little highway and onto the trackless playa, heading for a great emptiness over there. I spent many nights and days out in the Black Rock Playa, including times when the Burning Man celebration was going full swing. Just drive 10 more miles up the hard pan flat white playa, and it all fades away. It cannot be seen or heard. Or, if it makes you feel better, go 20 miles. My friend, the Japanese poet Shige, stood there one night looking at the stars in the sky with a tear in his eye, saying, "I never knew there were so many." That's in Japan, you don't get to see the stars so well. When I let my new dog out at daylight, she looked totally baffled by being surrounded by no phenomena at all. It was DeWayne's gift to make his circle of friends and family in Gerlach become the stars in the sky and put us all into the same universe using just the roadside rocks and never a mean word.
One more
brief comment. And I don't say this because I have an answer. I have no answer to this question. How come none of the Burning Man parties and the Burning Man people ever noticed it? And in the 25 or so books of photography and commentary on the Burning Man phenomenon, they never mention it that I know of. Isn't that strange?
Now we have a little time for questions. I don't know if it's possible to dim these spots. We can't really see people out there, but there are, I believe, a couple of microphones being circulated. As I say, I can't see. There's one here. And you're welcome to ask a question of any or all of the panelists.
Yeah, that's much better.
We have somebody over here, I think.
You have to have enough light to be able to see
hands. Yeah, we can't see it all.
Turn the light up a little, actually.
I work with the labor movement, and I'm also, like your work, your writing, and I'm an environmentalist. And I fear too many environmentalists look down on the people that do the work in the countryside, the agricultural workers, the forestry workers, identifying them with the corporations that are doing so much damage. And I think that your work speaks against that kind of elitism. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about appreciation for work and the workers of our rural areas.
Is that for Gary?
Yeah.
I think I could hear that. You know, I'm not going to talk about that. What I'm going to say is get a job and find out what work is like. And get a job in which you have to learn what you're doing. So that's the only way I ever learned. And then you get to know the people that do the work.
Over here, I think. Poor guy. We've got a couple of hands here, but I don't see a microphone.
We've got to go with the mic.
Okay. Hi, Gary. Hi, everybody. Larry Harvey, the founder of Burning Man, died this morning. And that's not my real comment, but I thought people might want to know. So it was really nice to be here, and unrelated to that, hear you speak of the Black Rock Desert. The other thing I'd like to say is, I don't know all the books of photographs of Burning Man, but I have heard a couple people who are part of the Burning Man community who have actually moved to Gerlach speak of this place. So it hasn't come out in public, but I do think some of the people who have become a part of that community because of the Burning Man do know about Guru Lane. So I just want to let you know, I believe they do.
I know that there's some truth in that, because there are a small number of people for whom the Burning Man experience converted them to want to live in Gerlach. And become kind of locals. And that's a different world. But it can be bridged. And the one thing that they share is cannabis.
Thus, Doobie Lane.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Sort of struck by, I guess it's irony, of having, and this goes to the Thorovians, I think, of the Paiute Pass in the Sierras framed by mountains named after New England Transcendentalists. And I'm wondering if this is something, I mean, if you've been able to engage with current members of any of the federally recognized Paiute tribes, and you know, get them to join in, or whether they have thoughts on this, or whether that's kind of beside the point of what you're doing.
They do have thoughts on that, and we've been in conversation. We were very careful to tell the story that this was, well, let me just back up, that place names arise from the significance to the namers. And even the Paiute people, even their own name is the name for them, is them identifying themselves. Actually, that was the name that the people who encountered them gave them. So we addressed that. I addressed that specifically in the beginning of the book. I don't think we can stop people from naming, and I don't think that we stop people from naming for the influences on them. What we can do is acknowledge that places have more names than we can possibly know. It's like we're still counting the stars, we're still naming the stars, the names are innumerable. What we can do is say we gave this name in honor of something that we did that is in honor of people that came before us. I don't know the name of those peaks because I don't specifically know people who can tell me with authority what the names of those peaks are, but we do know that there's those thousands and, I won't say thousands, innumerable names. It's a really good question, thank you.
Yeah, I want to add that the high country of the Sierra was never permanently occupied because of the snows, but it was a summer meeting place for the Paiute and the Miwok to trade, and we have really good evidence of that because there is no native obsidian in the High Sierra. It's only in the Owens Valley. So when you find areas that are covered with obsidian chips in the High Sierra, you know how it got there. And sometimes we have stumbled across sites that we report to the state archaeologist and have literally thousands of obsidian chips so that the afternoon light makes the hill light up like diamonds. And at that point, you know that place had a name and had hundreds of years of occupation in the summer times only. And it's a truly beautiful experience.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if you might speak to the civil disobedience piece of your story.
Yes, and actually one of the essayists speaks to that. It was illegal for us to name the peak Mount Thoreau because federal legislation says that there are no more names to be applied. So the quote marks are our registration of the act of civil disobedience.
I will say the U.S. Geological Survey neither approves nor disapproves.
And we are not, our act was not antagonistic to the legislation that they are following. We all want to support the Wilderness Act of 1964. We want it to stay in force. But I have to just say the same thing again. People will name things no matter what you do. If you legislate against it, they'll put it in quotes. So that's what we did.
Oh, okay.
Where is the microphone, man?
Yeah. When I was young and going to the Art Institute in San Francisco, this is a little off the subject about ecology, but I first, I was at a mentor, Wally Hendricks, who was Gallery 6, and he organized the poetry reading where Howl was read the first time, and I understood you read poetry that day too, since it was sort of the start of the beat movement. Could you speak about that a little bit?
He's asking about Sixth the day that Howl reading. Was read for the first time.
Well, what would you like to know? I mean, we all know about those.
Who did the introduction?
I don't remember who did Kenneth the introduction. Rexroth. Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. He tells me that Kenneth Rexroth introduced everybody. So, those of you who don't know Kenneth Rexroth's names, everybody knows his name here, right?
We're in San Francisco.
Yeah. Hey, there was a great article in The Nation three or four issues back going over Ezra Pound's life and a political career that was very interestingly respectful of Ezra as the poet that he was as far as he was a poet, and also quite clear and critical of how deeply involved during the World War II especially he was with Mussolini and Mussolini's politics. And he handed himself in to the American authorities after the war and said, "You want me?" But that's going some different direction.
Hey, I had the pleasure of watching a documentary of sorts with you and Jim Harrison.
Oh, yeah.
Jim passed in the last little while here. I wonder if you had any reflections on your relationship with him.
With Jim Harrison?
Yes.
You know, I really loved Jim Harrison, and I wouldn't say that if it wasn't kind of forced on me by the way he is or was. I think he was an extraordinarily good writer. But the thing that made his writing so attractive and interesting and drawing you to it was the variety of dialects of spoken American English that he could write in, and he could pick up any of a variety of working class slang, bar, whorehouse conversations, make them all happen, and then switch into academies or bourgeois boringness, you know, a whole variety of, and it's all the upper Midwest too, basically. That's one of his great challenges that he met was being able to write about working people of a number of varieties. Another great strength that I think he had was he was a remarkable describer of violence. His little novel, Revenge, or novella, and the novella that went with it at the same time, which I've forgotten the name of. Anyway, those are two cases of you'll never see better writing about violence, whether you like it or not.
Legends of the Fall.
Legends of the Fall, yeah.
Back here.
Oh, thank you. To return quickly to the Thoreauvians and the inclusion of civil disobedience in the title, I was wondering if any of you could speak a little bit to how you think the naming of Mount Thoreau might be joining the legacy of civil disobedience by challenging in any way the sort of colonialist practices of white supremacy and the use of quote-unquote wilderness land in California.
It's become a problem in Muir studies. Thoreau was assembling a book about the Native Americans that would have been immense and would have done the same job as the early ethnographer, Morgan, who wrote The League of the Iroquois. Thoreau was preparing to do that project when he died at age 44 of tuberculosis. And after his time in Maine, he got really interested in the Native Americans still alive around him. And this book would have been one of the great American books, lost to tuberculosis. And there's a good essay describing what that book would have been. And it's in the 20th Century Views series on Thoreau. It's by Ed Fussell. Edward Fussell wrote this essay, Thoreau's Lost Book. Now, Muir grew up on a farm in Wisconsin where all of the Native Americans had been killed or died of disease. And he didn't see them until they got to California. And so now the controversy has to do with this encounter he had with some Miwok Indians when he was crossing the northern Mono Pass. And he was surrounded by a group of men who asked him for tobacco and alcohol. And he writes a paragraph in My First Summer in the Sierras that expresses his repulsion and his uncomfortableness at the men who had surrounded him. And so that's been taken as evidence of Muir being a, quote, Indian hater. And there isn't any other written evidence in the Muir record to express that particular feeling. And Indian haters in the 1870s included people who were killing them for a bounty. So on the very next page, Muir says, "It seems very unfortunate to care for woodchucks and squirrels more than for your fellow species, and I hope to be better. I don't like how I felt. And someday it'll be like Robbie Burns said, we'll all be brothers." And so This is Muir as a young man, and then as an old man, he spent time in Alaska with the Tlingit, and he was tremendously impressed and wrote glowingly about their treatment of their children, because he had been an abused child, and their general level of sophistication in nature. So I would say it needs to be said that Muir was not in that camp, which was quite active in the 19th century against Native Americans, and he even joined the Sequoia Society, which helped California Indians in his time. So this is really, it needs to be said, because in our culture, if a bad phrase gets out about somebody, you know, showed up in the LA Times about 5 years ago, and it's like a fire you can't put out. Oh, Muir was a prejudiced against Indians. Muir was a racist. It's not in the record. Muir wasn't, in his own words, you can find evidence that he was, for his time, incredibly enlightened person towards both Native Americans and for animals of all kinds. So here's to John Muir. He's actually still worthy of our affection and respect in a way that some of his fellow citizens of his time weren't.
And I think I'll say something about women's voices and about the... Oh, now there I am. There's my voice.
Yep.
I think as a woman writer that I reflect on the process of my now being able to say, sit at this table and speak about my experience of being on the mountain with the men and the other women who were there. I think the tricky thing is to recognize that the voices were not being heard and begin to hear all the voices. I think this book fest is a really great example of that. You could look at the history of who gets to speak at this fest and how it is broadening, but that at the same time, the voices that have moved us and made us who we are also continue to need to be in circulation with us. So I do see us as acknowledging who made us who we are in a way that doesn't shut off the rest of the voices, but names the ones that are still resonating with us, leaving room for so many more to come in.
I just had a quick question for Gary Snyder relating to the Dubie Lane book. I wondered if the carver of the stones, Duane, saw the book.
No, he died before it came out. And in the conversations I had with him, very relaxed, out in that hot sun, I told him, I said, I'm writing some of this down. Somehow he knew that I had written poems, and he said, "That's good. That's what you do."
Yeah. He did see some of the photographs.
Well, Gary, in terms of this Dubie Lane book,
it's Mark Malcolm.
Can you compare it with the Chinese poetry? There's something about the relaxed cadence of it all. There's something about its specificity and written on stone. Is this like Chinese poetry?
Could you say that again more slowly?
Yeah.
I don't hear all that well. I'm an old guy.
Well, okay, I'll try again. So, the Dubie Lane book.
Yeah.
There's something in that relaxed cadence of it all. There's something in that ordinary speech. There's something in the fact that it's written on stone. Can you compare this with Chinese poetry?
That's an interesting thought. I could go on for a long time about that. I would like to see what the Chinese would do with it, actually. But yeah, you know, you're going the right direction there, because there's an awful lot of Chinese poetry, early Chinese poetry, that takes ordinary language and ordinary things that people would say and talk about and gives it just a little bit of a tweak and makes it into a line of poetry, which is also, you know, the mystery of how they get away with writing all those dumb little haiku.
Somebody else have something to say?
This is for Kim. I really appreciated your thoughtful reflection about contextualizing what's been found in Muir's writings about Native Americans, but I at the same time, I don't mean to, you know, make this what this afternoon is about, but could any of you speak to the fact that a lot of environmentalists were also eugenicists, including President Teddy Roosevelt and others. I mean, in other words, I appreciate and respect what you're offering, and it was illuminating to me your perspective. But there's a larger issue.
Yes, thank you for that, and it's relevant to the Sierra. I think Muir never had anything to do with that, which is a blessing. But in the evolution circle, there is a Mount Spencer and there is a Mount Haeckel. Now, I'm open to the notion that there ought not to be a Mount Spencer and a Mount Haeckel for that very point that they, and of course this is judging the past, but what do you do with people who are racist to that degree? I mean, and contributed to the theories that led to the huge genocidal disasters of the 20th century. I'm uncomfortable whenever you go through a certain pass, and Gary has climbed Mount Haeckel, and Ernest Haeckel, he was a early evolutionary scientist who very much believed in different levels of intelligence of the races and had eugenicist ideas that certain species, like certain species, went extinct. It was essentially social Darwinism at its worst. Well, let's change those names. Why not? The names change. The names, they come and go. We give names for a reason. I think it's absolutely legitimate to question and change those. And that's about all I have to say about that one.
It's interesting. It would be interesting to think about how you would go about having a conversation to do that. And that conversation would be the thing that was of value.
Mm-hmm. I read a book in the 70s, which...
Thank you.
Which, anyway, the author was comparing Allen Ginsberg as the Walt Whitman of the Beat Generation, and he called Gary Snyder the Henry David Thoreau of the Beat Generation. Just wondered how Gary felt about that.
Well, I think it's stupid. In both cases.
Let's not end on that note. Can we have one more question and not end on that?
One more question, and I think we have...
This is just very short, but I wanted to let you know in terms of naming that one of the elementary schools in Berkeley, LeConte Elementary, will be renamed because of who LeConte was. So renaming is also an issue, I think.
I wonder, there's LeConte Senior and LeConte Junior. I'm not aware that little Joe LeConte was ever a problem, but maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, that's interesting, and I'm glad that people are making those considerations.
Well, I want to thank all of our panelists for being here today. And thank you all. We are going to sign some books in a few minutes. I just wanted to take a second to say that in about 10 days, Gary Snyder is going to turn 88 years old. And I think it's about time for us to find a nice mountain peak in the Sierras that needs his name on it.
I know the peak. I've got it picked.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.